So hi, cool. Steve Parry, interviewing you at the Angel Comedy Club again.
Indeed, yes. We've just finished an action-packed, glorious evening.
I sort of wanted to ask you particularly because you're very strong on one side of the fence and you're growing in another side of the fence. You're mainly a comedy writer.
Yeah, that's right.
How did you... Let's first go into, because you're now a stand-up, what was the moment where you decided to actually get up on stage and actually start performing? Do you remember the pivotal moment?
I've always performed. I've always been involved in acting or school plays or all the rest of it. So I suppose I've always been a show-off, really. And the comedy writing largely came from not being... Because I had a go at stand-up before I had a go at comedy writing. I always did okay. You know, I was one of these people who sort of, was back in my little house with my mum in Wales learning, you know, and I'd go off and I'd get a gig in Bristol.
When I was
18, 19 or something, you know, I remember getting a gig in Bristol, and I'd never done a stand-up gig before, and I just turned up with something to do and did it, and it went all right, and it wasn't too bad, and everyone seemed, it was, 5 minutes, quite good, and then I sort of started signing up for these competitions. I had no idea really about, I read the instructions like most people do for things like the Daily Telegraph over my coordinates. You know, must be amateur comedian, must only have been going for a year and stuff. I didn't realise that was all lies, really, to make it sound like a more exciting competition. Didn't realise that they were actually platforms for essentially semi-professional comedians
who already had agents.
Yeah, to get a leapfrog into being a proper comic, which now I know and think is probably fair enough and quite a good idea. But I did the Daily Telegraph open mic thing in about, in the mid-90s or something like that. And I'd never done, never done any gigs before. Turned up, did well, got through to the next round, which was in Birmingham or something like that. Didn't do any gigs in between. Turned up to that. It was okay. And then I got through to the semi-final of that. And so I thought, fucking hell, I'm good at this. So I turned up to that. And I was shit. You know, I was completely blown out of the water and
your
hopeless.
Third gig.
Yeah, it was my third gig, not my confidence massively. I suddenly thought, I'm shit at this, what's the point? But I suppose really, I mean, getting back to the original question about performing, the thing I've always liked doing, always wanted to do, is perform. And I used to do a lot of acting, so I was a member of the National Youth Theatre. And, looking back on it now, it was a really sort of good period to have been in the National Youth Theatre. You know, people like Matt Lucas and David Walliams were both there doing their things. Orlando Bloom was a stage, carrying spears in Othello, and all these sorts of things. And you still, to this day, I still see faces every week on TV that were there in that period. And I suppose that having done that and realising that I enjoyed it, the problem I had was, how do you become a performer? I didn't go to drama school, I didn't do those things, because I came from a background where the idea was that if you were reasonably bright or reasonably, good at something, you did your A-levels and you went off to university, which is what I did, and had a marvellous time and became exceptionally left-wing and sold lots of newspapers on street corners rather than doing gigs and...
What was your degree?
I did politics, a politics degree. Just went and had a laugh and did university. And then I still was full of the idea of, right, I'll finish this and then I'll go off and be an actor now then. And then, of course, that's not how it works, is it? So I came to London, started working in journalism. And I realised very quickly with that, actually, that being a journalist was not for me. I wasn't interested in accuracy, facts and figures, objectivity, any of those things. I thought that was all a load of crap. So I started writing funny things and, trying to get those in newspapers or on websites, early days of websites and things. But, did a few things for the Guardian website before it became important and good. It was just a sort of mad experiment that they thought we better throw some money at this. And they had a website called Shift Control, and I did a little funny sort of column on that, which were not under my own name, under I think it's called Roland's Rant, and it was sponsored by Rolling Rock Beer, and so you had to just write 100 words on something funny once a week. I quite enjoyed doing that. And then I started working in telly more, because again, I thought, it's all this, if you're not involved in the industry, you think, well, you know, if you get involved in it, if you get in behind the scenes, eventually someone will say, you really want to be on TV, here you go, go on telly. And of course it doesn't work like that. In fact, the longer I found that I worked within television or theatre or whatever it was, as a writer or a researcher or as a producer, the less and less and less chance there was of actually ever being a performer. So I decided to come back to what I really wanted to do and focus on stand-up and start trying to do it properly, really. And so I did that a few years ago, if the truth be known, and I, again, sort of stuck in it for about a year, and it went quite well. You know, I had quite a good 10 minutes, I wasn't too bad, I was quite chatty on stage, quite good at the improvising with the crowd and having a bit of a laugh. But what I couldn't stand was really going round little crappy pubs doing gigs to five people, most of whom were acts anyway. You know, what I wanted was the bright lights and the big crowds and all that. And I realised that, and I got dejected is the word, isn't it? Got dejected by that and sort of again gave up on that and started concentrating more on writing. And I suppose, really, I just got more and more... I wasn't very satisfied by writing, even though you're writing jokes that, you know are getting on the telly and people are or on the radio or something and people are laughing. You're making lots and lots of people laugh with your ideas, but someone else is actually...
receiving the acclaim.
Doing, yeah. Not necessarily getting the acclaim, it was somebody else was getting my laughs, and that... Much as I still like that, I find that quite irritating. And there's nothing beats getting the laughs yourself. So I came back to stand-up and started saying, right, I'm going to stick at this, and I'm not going to give up just because I'm getting bored of trotting out the same material in the same clubs. And that's what I've done, really. I sort of deliberately stuck to the same set, even though I was writing all the time. So, you know, I was doing a set that was probably not as funny as things that I maybe was writing, 6 months later. But even so, I said, no, I'm going to stick to this set. I'm just going to keep doing, at least for a bit, I'll throw in odd bits, but I'm going to stick to a basic structure that I'm doing. I'm not going to change it all the time. I'm not going to keep doing it. I mean, I should say at this point, I used to be in a double act called Chocolate Sandwich, which is a surreal double act. And it was because I think that it was the late 90s, really, and the comedy circuit, certainly the amateur comedy circuit, was in the doldrums at that period. I think every single act who turned up was a wannabe TV presenter. They weren't interested in having something to say or in what was, I suppose, the spirit of alternative comedy. It was the death knell of alternative comedy. And a lot of the clubs were very, very depressing places, really. They were either people who wanted to be TV presenters or they were people with mental illnesses who really should have been speaking to therapists. I fell somewhere between both stools, I think. So that got a bit depressing. We did Chocolate Sandwich, which was a sort of the antidote to stand-up comedy. We broke all the rules of stand-up comedy. We went on too long. We deliberately overran. We deliberately heckled the other acts. We the act started the minute we arrived at the club and ended the minute we were either ejected from the club or the audience left, really. And we really enjoyed it, and we had a good time with it. But it wasn't a stand-up thing, really. That's what we learned. It wasn't... Stand-up clubs weren't interested. We did, we'd get laughs, and we'd do quite well. And then at the end of the night, we'd speak to the promoter, and they'd go, yeah, but you're not really a comedy act, are you? You're not really stand-up. We're not really going to book you again. So, well, yeah, but they laughed. So surely this is in the spirit of comedy, of stand-up. People want to see variety. It's variety, really, modern variety. And people didn't want to know. So we started doing that more on a sort of... to be honest, the art and the music crowds really got into it more. Really, we were the still life what do they call it when you strip off and stand there naked and people paint you? You're the model.
Yeah.
We didn't do that.
Art models.
We went to the Royal. We were asked to go to the Royal College of Art and be the still life models, but do a performance. We did a 3-hour performance for the students at the Royal College, and they painted or drew whatever they were inspired by us doing it. And, you know, so we were getting weird little gigs like that. We did a gig in, we were asked to do an all-day performance at the Paul Smith Children's, the flagship store of the Paul Smith Shop. We're having a bit of a revamp, and they wanted something to unusual, a little thing they were curating in the day. So we did a an all-day chocolate sandwich performance in the children's section of the Paul Foot Shop. Paul Foot Shop. That's
Paul Smith.
Fuck you! Can you imagine if Paul Foot had a shop? You remember what he'd sell? Paul, should say, Paul, in case people don't know, Paul Foot is an incredibly funny, incredibly camp, incredibly odd comedian. And if he had a shop, it would be the sort of place that you could. Well, you'd either go there every day, or you'd go once and move cities so you could be far enough away from it never to have to go again. But yeah, so we did stuff there, and we started doing interesting little gigs like that. But always, whenever we returned to the comedy circuit, we were given, you know, we were told
thumbs down.
To piss off.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, really enjoyed doing that. Needed to get it out of our systems. And I got quite depressed by comedy full stop then, really, and started just working solely, really, were writing gags for comics to do monologues or sketches. You know, people like Frank Skinner or Graham Norton, or, you know, either coming up with funny things for them to do, i.e. producing items for those shows, or coming up with jokes for them to tell in their opening monologues. And I suppose, really, I learned how to do it, really. I learned how to write a joke. And once I'd done that, I felt, well, you know, essentially, if I can memorise 10 minutes of this, then I can go out and start building a show, building my own act. Because I realised that you've got to find your own voice as a comic, and it's no good. You can write a million things for a million different people, for the best comedian in the world, for the worst comedian in the world. It doesn't matter. If you're not out there performing every night, you're never going to get anywhere. Comedy, certainly stand-up, I think, is quite meritocratic in that sense. It's quite fair in that terrible comics can become very, very good comics through practice. If you work hard, you get the rewards. And I've always been a little bit lazy like that, and I've sort of learned over the years that if you do that, I'd just be a bitter old man going, I could have been a contender, Charlie. And I, you know, that's sort of how I'm shaping up at the moment, really. So I thought, well, I better not do that. I better go out and at least say, well, I gave it a go, and I'm, you know,
because that's for me one of the things that differentiates a comic writer and a comic performer or a stand-up comic is a comic writer, in a way, has to get themselves into the other person's persona, and in your case, many different people's persona. You couldn't do a Frank Skinner joke for Graham Norton.
Well, no, not at all. No, absolutely. And the reason Frank Skinner is hilariously funny is not necessarily the material that he says. It is
he has found a
hilarious voice. And so he could stand on stage and recite the alphabet, and he would be funny, you know. And the same for Graham Norton, or for I'm lost for names at the moment, but anybody like that, you know, that the thing that makes them funny isn't necessarily what they're saying. It's the way you tell them. That's the secret. That's what I think at the moment. It changes all the time, by the way. I always think it's quite dangerous to philosophise too much about it, comedy. Not that you'd believe that, having listened to me rant on without taking breath for the last 5 minutes.
But that's what must be, in a way, your challenge, is to actually find out what your voice is.
As soon as I stop thinking about it, it goes better. But, you know, that's the thing.
Don't you sometimes write jokes for yourself and think, actually, I can't do that, but that's really good, I can sell that on to somebody else, because it isn't what your persona or where you're coming from.
I suppose so. I mean, I must say that at the moment I'm sort of, yeah, I suppose so. At the moment, because I'm mainly writing gags for people, then the fact that if it's a good gag, you sort of think, well, maybe I can hold on to that and keep that. But you don't. I mean, that professionally, you just don't do that. You just I think that it's a real mistake as a comedian to think that, like, comedians are really uppity and really worried when they see people doing similar material. to them or gangs to them, and they're always convinced that that person's seen them at a club and nicked it. They haven't. They've just had the same idea as you. You're not a fucking genius. Mm. You're coming up with ideas on similar subjects about similar things, and you're going to have overlap. And I think that, you know, you've just got to be... And that's what happens when you're writing for somebody else. You do occasionally write a joke, you think, that's a corker. Oh, I should keep that. That would really work in my set. I could see how that would really fit. But you've just got to, you know, you're being paid to write it for somebody else. You've just got to give it to them and have the confidence that you will come up with another idea. And you will. If you're any good, you will. Which is why, you know, I never really worry about seeing comics who are clearly ripping off other acts, which you do see occasionally. Because, you know, they will eventually run out of people to nick stuff off. And I suppose then, by that stage, they'll probably be on telly and they can hire people to come up with jokes for them.
Like you.
But, yeah. But you know, at the end of the day, I think that, you know, you've just got to have... And it's the same in every aspect of life, I think, you know. People get uppity about, they nick my film script, they nick my book, that bloke, you know. Have another good idea then. Go off, if you have good ideas, go off and have another one. Don't be twisted about it, otherwise you just become some bitter...
But when you're trying to develop your own persona, don't you find that you might write a joke and think, no, that won't really work with my persona, or do you not think...
I don't even think about it in terms of my persona, really, anymore. I did for a while, and I found that it just... I seized up. I mean, I think, like I said earlier, I think there is only one way to find your persona, and that is to let it find you, really, by doing lots and lots and lots and lots of gigs. And that's why comics, you know, and I'm sure you won't mind me saying this, but, you know... A brilliant comic, I think, Steve Williams, is a comic who, you know, when he started, a brilliant comic. He's one of the best comics around, and he's absolutely fantastic. I've known him since he was a kid. You know, we grew up together. We were friends when we were at school and all that stuff. And Steve will be the first one to tell you. For the first year, you know, he was not the. He was a good. He had good material. Terrible performer. You know, and yet he. Loved it, had something to say, stuck at it, and now he's probably the best, you know. Or in a, you know, you can count him on the fingers of the one hand who can beat him on a stage, and you know, he's an example, I think, of how you do it. And I've never spoken to Steve about how he goes about it, but I think the only thing for me is to stop thinking about the persona thing and just to start just to go out and do it, and, you know, that's what I'm doing now. And once you get over that and just start enjoying that as a process, you just go, well, you know, maybe this will just be my hobby for the rest of my life. That's fine, then. You know, as long as you just take that approach, I think you probably get better, and I think you probably become a funnier person generally. You know, because you never get your biggest laughs off your jokes, really, in many ways. You know, I find, you know, you've got to look at what makes other people laugh about you, not what you want them to laugh at about you.
And or what promoters tell you.
Yeah, just big up the things that make people really listen to the things that make people laugh about you, not the things that you think are funny about you. Mm. And if you do that, then I think, and you have the... Actually, people think comedians are all about having a big ego. Actually, it's about dropping, I think. Again, I mean, you know, I'm speaking from a position of trying to do it, not from being in a position where I'm, you know, I am it, you know, but I do think if you just, your ego can get in the way, so you can go, that bastard, they don't know what they're talking about. Actually, if they laughed at something that, you know, a funny look you did, or, you know, whatever, I know comedians who, you know, I remember a guy, I can't remember his name, he was a really nice guy, and he was had quite good gags, but he had a bog eye, really pronounced, obvious bog eye, he was cockeyed, and everyone noticed, and everyone thought it was hilarious, except him. He was gutted that he had a bog eye. It hurt like hell that he was the bloke with the, you know, the lazy eye and things, and it gutted him. But that was his key to it all. And I think that, you know, I find it easier to see it in other people than myself. So I have no, well, you know, I don't know whether I'm talking bollocks or whether I'm talking, you know, sense, but I do genuinely think that if you... try and look at what it is that other people laugh at about you, do that, and also accept that normally the simpler the thing you do, the more effective it is, I think.
Because back to what you were saying about dropping the ego, I think one of the things that I had to learn after about a year of dying on my ass was actually listening to what the audience was responding to,
yeah,
bigging that up. even though I didn't know it existed in myself. You know, I found that mugging, for instance, makes the audience laugh, which I never thought was particularly funny. Mm. But there are certain points where I can really mug.
Yeah.
And I know now that it works. I don't particularly necessarily understand why it's funny. Or I'll do, particularly when I'm emceeing, I'll do a throwaway line that I didn't just came out of the top of my head. And I find that, if I really listen to the audience and build on that, that is what then becomes...
Yeah.
Because it's still true to me. It's really me. But it's an aspect of myself that I'm exploding out because I realise that's what they're responding to. It's like you've got red hair, which is an obvious thing for a comic to...
Yeah, and I've always been, you know, I've never been afraid of taking the mick out of it, I suppose, in many ways. But, you know, people do. I mean, people take the piss out of people with red hair, all of that stuff. But I've only very recently incorporated anything about it into my act. And...
But in the way, it's like the bog eyed story, you've got to mention it.
Well, of course you have, because the first thing they notice when you walk on stage is that you've got a bright flock of red hair on top of your head. So either you wait for them to show, oh, Mick Hucknall, or, you know, whatever happened to fucking little orphan Annie. You know, either you wait for them to shout at you, or you say it to them. Mm. And I think saying it to them relaxes an audience, because they realise that you're not going to, you know, you are going to take the mickey out yourself, and... You know, that essentially, for me, I think, you know, the way my act or my persona on stage is ultimately self-depreciating. You know, I am a bit of a messy, I can't get my shit together, and I can't, you know, and I don't get time for a haircut, and I, you know, I have bright red curly hair and stupid freckles, and,
Wear a suit.
Yeah, you know, and I'm, you know, and things about me that I don't particularly like and really frustrate me, you know, are things that other people laugh at and take the piss out of before. And if I want to get in on taking the piss out of myself, then I've got to do that, haven't I? You know, and it's the same for fat people, bald people, gay people, you know.
I just heard this great story about this girl in the pub who, a guy was helping her on with her coat and her wig fell off.
Right.
She was so mortified, she picked up and she ran out of the pub, and the guy followed her to try and help her out. And I just thought that, in a way, is the key of what a comic tries to do, is make the wig fall off, but say, laugh with me, not at me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, to be honest, I think most comics would settle for laugh at when they're having a rough gig and they're up on stage, you know. I mean,
But then, they've got to somehow front it up and just go with it, and not try and hide the fact and sort of run off stage.
Well, you know, we're all a bit, you know, we've all got our foibles, and that is, in a way, a large part of what comedy's about is unpicking those. From, you know, it's like, you know, if there's a scab there, scratch it, because you know it'll yield something. It might not be necessarily what you want it to yield. You know, my comedy heroes are people like Vic Reeves and Spike Milligan and Peter Cook, you know, massively inventive surrealist comics. That isn't what I am. That is what I would like. If I could pick what type of comic I'm going to be, you know, I'd go on stage and talk about, you know, the precisely, you know, the, I don't know, you know, my shoe hat, you know, and how my shoe hat where a raven nests, and you know the egg that I keep in my breast pocket. But you know, of course, I'm not a surreal comic, although, you know, my trains of thought on normal subjects are quite surreal. So what I find now is that I always start with something that people know about, or that is broadly sort of
mundane,
common or mundane or topical or whatever it might be, and start quite traditionally on it with a few jokes and a straightforward, and then I try and take them on my tangent on that subject, and you know, that's very, very different from building your own world where, you know, you know some comics need to build their own world, and if people are willing to enter that world, they'll have a massively exciting, fun, surreal time. But I suppose, you know, we talked about the politics earlier on and stuff like that, and how, you know, been involved in, you know, left-wing politics and things like that in the past, and still am in, you know, quite a bit. Yeah, and, you know, I think that those things do irritate me and do annoy me, and I do think are important. So I do think that, you know, it's quite, you know, again, most people think that's boring as shit. because I'm obsessed by it. So all I can do is laugh with them at my stupidity for thinking that, you know, we can make this world a better place. You know, I mean, I don't mind them laughing along with me, because along the way I would have told them what I think. You know, so
that's what, going back to that and scratching the spot. I think that's why sometimes some people perceive comics to have a big ego, because they think you have to have a big ego to scratch the spot. But I don't think that necessarily relates. I think the comic is the person who is laughing enough at their spot to be able to scratch it. Who's actually laughing at their seriousness about something like politics.
Well, I suppose because Bill Hicks is the ultimate example of it, really, isn't he? But I think just on a very personal level, an awful lot of comics I find it quite hard a lot of the time to get on with comedians, because, you know, you're either with like-minded people so everyone's trying to get one out over on someone, in which case you never have a proper conversation with anyone ever. And it's all about, you know, it's basically who's got the biggest dick sort of one-upmanship stuff. It's all good fun, nice banter. Or you chat to people and they're very closed and worried and self-absorbed and a bit uptight as real people. And again, you know, that on stage can be an enormously brilliant thing to watch, but it often is very difficult. I don't know if you agree with me, I think that a lot of the time comics are almost scared to be funny in the pub or, you know, just in life, because they feel like people think they're doing their act.
Hmm.
And, you know, in a way, that's what I hope one day to be able to try and show on stage, really. You know, I like that style of comic who's like the funniest bloke in the pub, your mate, you know. Look at the success of somebody like Peter Kay, who, you know, is a brilliant comic. And again, you know, his material is really just about hitting reference points that people relate to and saying the sort of thing your dad might say about them, to be honest. But he lets you know that he's saying the thing that your dad might say about them. So, you know, he's basically admitted he's a bit of a daft old fart, isn't he, really? And you know, that's how he sort of, you know, how people warm to him, because he's like their dad or their brother or their, you know, the bloke they know, Dan the Boozer.
The bad dancer at the wedding.
Yeah. You know, and that ultimately, that will always be funnier than comedians anyway.
Mm.
The human species are endlessly, endlessly entertaining. There was a thing in the paper today, marvellous newspaper, The Daily Sport. I recommend it. If you've never read it, you must read it. Learn all about granny dogging. Learn all about, endlessly fascinating perversions of the human race. There was a thing today in the paper, right, about this bloke, this massively fat bloke, right? He's so fat. And to illustrate how fat he was, they had him on a bed, on his leaning up on his knees, with a topless woman next to him holding her breasts, and he was holding his breasts, mimicking her pose.
And they were bigger than
hers. They were much bigger than hers. They were quite nice, actually. They weren't at all. You know, I wouldn't have been ashamed of them if they were mine. But he wasn't. He had them out in the paper. But what they were saying is that this man is so fat now that he may have to have his legs amputated. Now, that's a drastic way of losing weight. You know, he will lose some weight by doing that, but he won't necessarily. But what they did is they got a photo of him, and they asked him to just sit on a chair and just push his legs up under the chair and under the cat, and took a photo of him under the cat, and said what he might look like once he's had his legs amputated. Now, what was going on in his mind, the journalist's mind, the photographer's mind, to think, let's just get a shot of him, what he might look like once he's had his legs amputated. And it's just, you know, it's stupid, it's bollocks, but, you know, it's ludicrous. But the human species are endlessly entertaining. I'm trying to think of other examples. I mean, they just come along all the time. So, I mean, you know, they're like buses.
He was like a bus. Because the other thing is, I mean, you're Welsh, and that's something that, again, I feel, I talked to Steve Williams about this, is I think the Welsh have a particular comic quality about them, similar to the Irish and similar to the Scottish. It's very particular to Wales. Do you think that?
I think there is a definite, I'm not sure I necessarily possess it. But I certainly do think there is a certain humour to the Welsh. It's very negative, actually. We're quite in many ways quite pessimistic bunch of people, in you know. And yeah, I don't know if it forms my comedy that much, being Welsh, because I must admit I don't. Yeah, I'm not sure it does, but I mean, again, you know, undoubtedly, you know, when, to be honest, if you watch something like Felix Knights, which again, going back to the Peter Kay thing, which very much focuses on regional humour and then and all that sort of thing.
Bolton.
Yeah, and it is a very, very sort of, you know, you're looking at a sort of 20 square miles or something, and this entire, you know, there is a definite comedy tradition that exists within that sort of area, from, you know, Les Dawson's and all the rest of it right through. Wales sort of has a bit of that, but it doesn't really have it in the same way. And if you look at something like Phoenix Knight, it could have been, that could almost have been set in Wales. There is a sense that it's the land that culture forgot in many senses. And because we've got a bit of our own, again, what is our own? Our own culture is putting on a rugby shirt, singing Bread of Heaven, and, you know, well, Max Boyce pretty much sewed up that, you know, line of
For me as an outsider who's worked...
What do you think's funny about the Welsh, then?
Well, it's not funny about the Welsh, but the Welsh way of expressing themselves comedically, if you like, which you get much more in pubs, individuals, and particularly in London, you very rarely get it. Steve Williams, I think, does do it on stage, and I don't think even he sees it as Welsh. But for me, that it is much more surreal. And it is quite dark, and it is pessimistic, and it is very, I hate using that word, self-deprecating comedy, because
I know what you mean. I mean, I suppose...
But it's like, don't really look at me, don't really pay attention to me, but this is what I think.
It's also a lot of things, I think a lot of my, the thing I find funniest, I suppose, I don't know, you know, perhaps I am informed by it, but I find, well, women run the roost in Wales. You know, my nan and my mum are really in charge. You know, they're the comic figures as well. You know, because, and a lot of it, I think, comes from saying things for the sake of saying things. You know, it's about gossipy, you know, never stop talking, you know, worrying about things, panicking, running, you know, I haven't stripped my beds, I've got to buy the turkey, it's not going to be defrosted in time. Well, I tried to buy some sage and onion stuffing, no sage and onion, I had to get a chestnut stuffing. Well, I know that John doesn't like chestnuts, so what are we going to do? I tell you what, I'll make a separate pile for him. You know, and it's panicking about nothing. And a good example of this was my nan last week. Wales played New Zealand in rugby last week, and we lost. But my brother was at the match, and so I was watching the game at home, and they were singing Bread of Heaven before the game. And lo and behold, the camera pans across, big old close-up on my brother singing Bread of Heaven, right? Now, the family were watching and everything, so we were all texting each other, we were phoning up, going, "Did you see Mick? Did you see him on the telly? Oh, I missed it, I just didn't see him." And I spoke to my nan a bit later on, I said, "Did you see Mick on the telly?" And she really wished she'd seen him. She didn't see him, really. She was going, "Yeah, I saw him. Well, I think I saw him. Well, you know, there was a chap who looked a bit... There was, but to be honest, Stephen, I mean, how on earth was I supposed to recognise him when he was wearing a blue top? You know, I thought he was wearing a green top. So how was I supposed to recognise my grandson because he was wearing a blue jumper?" You know, she didn't... And that, to me, is what... And whether that is... I don't know whether that's just sort of a working class thing, or whether that's a... Or whether that is a Welsh thing, really, I think. But, you know, it's a certain sense of sort of... No one... My nan speaks very quickly and says things very fast because she doesn't really think anyone's going to pay any attention to her or listen to her. So she doesn't even bother thinking about it, but it's nice to get it in if she can, you know. I mean, you know, the words per minute factor is phenomenal with the Welsh when you get them going. And I think that might be something to do with it. And there is a very much a sense of... I suppose... And I think, again, it's pub... thing. It comes from the pubs, you know, it's piss taking, really. It's taking the piss out of your mates. Rather, you know, if something bad happens to them, you don't check that they're all right, or you know,
stop
see
them
right.
Crying.
No, you take the piss out of them for it. And I think that sort of thing, I think, you know, is endlessly funny if you're not on the receiving end of it. And it's again what I came back to, really. If you can recognise what other people find funny about you, which is normally the fact that you've cocked something up. Can I swear on this?
But, yes.
Fucked something up. Fucked! I said fucked on a podcast! But if you fuck something up, or, you know, make a mess of something, or, you know, you dressed a bit badly, or, you know, there's nothing better than seeing a bloke having a drink before he's going to go and meet a girl for his first date or something, and you can see he's had a shave and he's put all his nice clothes on and love him, he's tried to look his best. And the thing to do is to go in and go, all right, mate, nice coat there, didn't they have it in your size? Yeah, or something like that, you know. Undermine the bastard before he goes, because it's far more entertaining to do that than it is to go, no, have a good time, no, she's a really nice girl, you know, and all that sort of stuff, you know. It's like, well, yeah, she's a really nice girl, yeah, she's got a lovely breast, when I've felt them, they were, you know, or whatever it is. I mean, that is a rubbish example, but, you know, that's the sort of thing I think that that I got from the Welsh.
Because, you know, for me also, there was, again, it's very difficult for me to remember, there was this wonderful sort of earthiness about it. I was working on a film and we were paying the extras about £5 a day, and they were, so it was set
big
in a mine, huge, and it was set in a mine, and this guy I'd, it was out in the valley somewhere, and I was a makeup artist, and I was covering them with coal dust so that they looked whatever. And about 2 days later, we had some of them come back to do another day's work. And this one guy still had the coal dust from 2 days previously. And the English person in me, of course, was very reticent and wanted to say, oh, you know, what, have you been down the mine in the last 2 days? You know, how come you still got it on you? And I didn't say anything at all, and I just added a bit more dust. And then I noticed on his neck he had this massive, great love bite. And I said, oh, did you have a nice time last night? And he just said, oh, yes, that was my petal. And I just cracked up laughing, because the guy was 60. He had very few teeth. He wasn't the cleanest person on the planet. And his petal was his wife.
Should have seen his fucking petal.
I wanted to. But there was something really...
I don't think she'd have a petal off a triffid. Quite possibly.
But he was so unembarrassed about it. Yeah. He was just like, no, this is, you know, fabulous. Yeah. And my wife thinks I'm fabulous. Or my petal.
Well, one of the things I mean, I suppose, chocolate sandwich, actually, when we were doing the surreal, the double act, with my friend Richard Thomas, who now is at Resonance Radio 104.4 FM, give him a little plug, because they're brilliant. But when we were doing that, you know, the things we would do is we'd do this little routine where we'd go, have you seen my son? Have you seen my son? What does he look like? Well, it's not hard to spot him, because his cock is massive! And he's, you know, we'd run around shouting, his cock is massive, in the faces of the audience, and bashing things and singing and all the rest of it. But the thing is, that comes from a genuine conversation that we overheard a woman talking to her friend in the pub about this bloke going, oh, I had this bloke last night, he bummed me lovely, but his cock was massive! And again, it's that sort of saying things without any thought at all for saying them. And
even if
you can pluck if you can pluck those out of the air and kind of somehow get them onto a piece of paper or into your brain so that you can say them again and again and again, then you've got it fucking made, really. But if you, you know, yeah, but you know, I'm more than happy really to just sort of, I just weep with laughter when I hear things like that, you know, it's just absolutely fantastic. But.
Well, I remember, because again, I was in so-called film biz, and we would take him to this club on a regular basis in Poncana, out in Cardiff.
Oh, yes.
And I can't remember the name of this club, but it was a front room with this woman upstairs, and as one of the guys who took me there, she was so large that when she stood up, her legs bled. Again, had me, you know, trying really hard with my English just to keep my face straight. But she was wonderful. It started at midnight and went through till whenever anyone went home at dawn. And it was a front room, and there was a few couches around. And every about an hour, she would hand out this silver, one of those silver plastic trays of sunblessed sandwiches with marmalade in them, or sometimes a bit of that Kraft cheese.
Yeah.
And she'd hand them round. And at one point, she gradually got to know me, and she realised I was, you know, in the film business, she called it, and she said, oh, yeah, this is the Groucho Club of Cardiff.
She was probably the Julie Birchall of Cardiff, wasn't it? I think Julie Birchall's legs bleed when she walks.
No. But it was just such a wonderful image, and she said it with such pride. And I said, because for those who don't know, Groucho's is a massively sort of, I don't know,
well, it's the
high-ranking media
it's
club.
It's the media haunt, isn't it, really?
And yes, it's crap as well, but in a different
I haven't really, they won't let me in. I did sneak in there once, actually, with a friend of mine. We went, I was working on a show, and we'd, we'd just gone out and got drunk, and we wanted a late drink, and neither of us were members of any clubs or anything like that, and none of the nightclubs were open, and we couldn't be bothered. So we said, let's try and black our way into the Groucho, because he knew, or he'd worked with Mark Lamar. So, what he did...
Sorry, guys, so a really low cap, actually.
Oh, right,
sorry.
Okay.
We'll carry on with this later.
Yeah, all right.
Thanks.